Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to the second day of issue-specific hearing number 8. As you'll be conscious if you were here yesterday, we are part the way through agenda item number 4, and that is where we will resume as we move forward today, with, critically, the need to complete all of the remaining agenda items in today's business. I will review the business of the day shortly, but just briefly before I do so, I'll carry out normal introductions. Now, can I just check, is there anybody here who was not here yesterday or who is not familiar with the venue at all? Yes, okay. Well, we will then do a measure of an introductory process to make sure that you're not at sea. Just to make clear that we have not been advised that there is any evacuation plan for the building this morning. So if we do hear the evacuation system go into action, it is the real thing. We leave this room through any of the large double doors to my left, marked as fire exits, proceed down the stairs, not using the lifts, into the lobby, and then there are fire exits into the courtyard area beneath us, where there is an assembly area for all of us if we need to leave the building. There are also gentlemen's facilities at the far end of the room, just immediately out of the furthest rear door to my left, and then the front door to my left, there are ladies' facilities immediately around the corner there. So that's the venue introduced. You now need to know who we are. My name is Rin Smith, and I'm the lead member of a panel that was appointed on the 2nd of October 2018 under Sections 61 and 65 of the Planning Act 2008 as amended under delegation from the Secretary of State to examine an application for the Thanet offshore wind farm extension. And I have made a declaration of interests responding to the Planning Inspectorate's conflicts of interest policy and can confirm that I have no declarable interests in relation to this appointment. And so I'll now introduce my colleagues.
Good morning. My name is Jessica Powis, and I can confirm I also have no declarable interests in relation to my appointment.
And then to my left.
My name is Stephen Bradley, and I have made a declaration of interest that until August last year, I was a volunteer writer for the Thames Estuary Partnership, and on appointment to this panel, I ceased further involvement.
Thank you very much. Over to my far right is Mr. Robert Ranger, who is a case manager with the Planning Inspectorate, one of the members of staff who is here assisting us in delivering this part of the examination. To the rear of the room and busily engaged in actually speaking to the sound technician is Mr. Bart Bartkowiak, who is also a case officer of the Planning Inspectorate. If anybody has any questions of any nature whatsoever, including during sessions, it's perfectly acceptable to quietly approach either of these two members of the Planning Inspectorate staff and make inquiries of them. They in turn can pass matters that need to be dealt with onto us. We are appointed to examine, as I said, the application for development consent for the Thanet Offshore Wind Farm Extension, a nationally significant infrastructure project. The application has been made by Vattenfall Limited, who we will be referring to as the applicant. I do not believe that there is any need to recite the details of that application, as I'm sure everybody is more than aware of it. Can I direct you then to my letter of the 9th of April, which contains the agenda for today? And if we can bring that up on screen and return to agenda item 4, which is where we're going to start, although where we currently are is somewhere in a repeat of one where we deal with introductions. So you obviously now know who we are. Let us move around the room in the normal way, and I will start with the Port of Tilbury and the London Gateway Ports Limited and ask for introductions.
Thank you, sir, and good morning. My name is Robbie Owen from Pinsent Masons, attending on behalf of Port of Tilbury and DP World London Gateway.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Vincent Crockett from HR Wallingford, also attending Port of Tilbury and DP World London Gateway. And I made the declaration of interest yesterday that we have worked with Marico Marine, and we also offer navigation simulation services.
Good morning, I'm Trevor Hutchinson. I'm planning the transportation consultant representing London Gateway Port Limited and Port Tilbury London Limited.
Good morning, Matthew Carpenter for Pinson Masons on behalf of London Gateway Port and Port of Tilbury.
Good morning, Nick Salter from the Maritime Coast Guard Agency.
Good morning, Rakesh Pandit from Maritime and Coast Guard Agency.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Roger Barker from Trinity House.
Thank you.
Trevor Harris from Trinity House, lovely to see you all again.
On such a beautiful sunny day.
Good morning, Fenner Boyle, UK Chamber of Shipping.
Thank you.
Good morning, Andrew Syme, London Pilot, representing the London Pilot Council.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Catherine Spain, Port of London Authority.
Thank you.
Morning, Alex Dillastone from Winkworth Sherwood, advising the Port of London Authority and Estuary Services Limited.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Richard Jackson, Estuary Services Limited.
Thank you. And now to the applicant.
Good morning, Scott Lyons, barrister for the applicant.
Good morning, Sean Leake, Goby Consultants for the applicant.
Good morning, Ed Rogers, Marico Marine for the applicant.
Good morning, Jamie Holmes, Shipping and Navigation Consultant for the applicant.
Good morning, apologies I wasn't here yesterday. Slightly longer introduction from me. Paul Brown, pilot, Class 1 pilot at the Port of Dover for 5 years. Now practice my piloting in the southwest, work as a principal consultant for Marico Marine, and that's my involvement here.
Thank you very much.
Morning, Captain Simon Moore, Master Mariner, representing the applicant.
Thank you.
Sammy Mullen, Goby Consultants, representing the applicant.
Thank you very much. Now, everybody is, I hope, aware, but I will remind you in any case that the reason you have microphones in front of you is that we do take a digital record of all of these proceedings, which will be published to our website and retained for a minimum of 5 years after the Secretary of State's decision. And therefore, if you speak to the microphones, be conscious of that, and we take it that you consent to the retention of your audio record on those terms. Now then, just one or two formal introductory matters that we then need to complete. I think it's first worth acknowledging very briefly that we have had one or two problems with the internet this morning. And as far as we are aware, we've been informed by facilities management in the building that those have been resolved. However, given that we are all intensely reliant on network connections, I would advise keep an eye on your connection. We have a number of 4G devices available to us so that we will be able, hopefully, to remain online and continue to deliver the hearing if there are any further problems. And we would also hope that if you folk have such similar devices available to you, phones that you can tether to, etc., that if the worst comes to the worst, we will just forge on. But I thought it would be worth highlighting that maybe some contingency arrangements might be required. I will also then just briefly flag in slightly more detail than I did at the outset where we are in terms of the business of today. Looking at the agenda, we believe that we have now completed items 1, 2, 3, 8, 9, 10 and 11. And we have reserved item 7 to writing. Today we have to do part of item 4. We need to complete the review of policy positions that we started work on yesterday. And then we have to undertake 5 and 6, where essentially the bulk of the remaining conversation around contended expert positions on navigation risk will take place. We then need to deal with 12, 13, 14, 15, 16 and 17. 14 through 17 are minor and swift items, you'll be pleased to hear, ladies and gentlemen, where we're basically just tidying up and washing up at the end of a hearing. Item 14 particularly I draw your attention to, because that is where we do deal with any procedural decisions that need to be made. So if anybody is asking us to decide something, that's the time when we will deal with such requests. We will foreshadow that we do need to return at that point to the question of the applicant's material change process, because we are conscious that the consultative part of that will take place after the closure of this round of hearings, and we need to at least be clear with the applicant precisely what is being done before we close this hearing. We propose to break for lunch today at the slightly kinder and earlier hour of 1 p.m. So that's the agenda. And then finally, ladies and gentlemen, one other procedural matter. We do have in the far rear of the room Mr. Graham Gould, who is a planning inspector who undertakes national infrastructure casework and is here observing this process on a training basis. He's here to see how it is done. In which case, unless there are any other matters of a procedural or a preliminary nature, we can then go to agenda item 4, where we will resume our passage through policy matters at the point that we ceased to deal with them yesterday evening. Does anybody have anything else to raise before we go there? No. Excellent. In which case, we are at 4H. Now, here we are dealing with the extent and nature of obstruction or danger to navigation, which, without amounting to interference with the use of sea lanes, is likely to be caused by the development. And the policy references here are 26168 and 26161, with regard both to the overall effect of development of the development in question and to any cumulative effects. There's a cross-reference there also to 2.6.169. Can I just see, we'll adopt the same procedure that we did yesterday, so we'll hear from the IPs first, and then we'll return to the applicant for response. Can I just see if there's a desire to speak to this particular policy item from this side of the room? Mr. Owen? Yes. MCA and Trinity House? No. UK Chamber of Shipping? London Pilots Council?
Yes.
Port of London Authority? Yes. And Estuary Services Limited. Okay. Mr. Owen.
Sir, thank you very much. Just a couple of quick points, if I may. The first is we don't have any comments on sort of cumulative impacts, if I can... cumulative effects, if I can summarise yeah. In that way. That's the first point. The second point is this probably isn't the right time today to develop it in detail and to look into it, but I would just register the point I made yesterday again that this does raise in my mind the issue as to the device being proposed by the applicant of a structures exclusion zone and what the DCO would nevertheless permit within the exclusion zone. I think it was Mr. Barker yesterday who was saying that, I may have misunderstood, in which case I apologise, but I thought I understood him to say that Trinity House certainly still wasn't clear what the DCO would permit within the structures exclusion zone. So that is something that I'd like us to explore, which, to my mind at least, this sub-item does raise as an issue. Thank you.
Indeed. And there will be possibly some supplementary questions of our own on that point. Now, moving around the table then, nothing from either MCA or Trinity House or UK Chamber of Shipping. So London Pilots Council, Mr. Syme.
Yes. I would like to bring into this, instead of our focus at the moment on a flat... looking down at a chart, just see what the nature of a wind farm does to safe navigation of vessels around the wind farm, and in particular use of radar for anti-collision and line of sight when observing vessels sight of one another in accordance with the collision regulations. And from my submission, you'll see that I've asked for all of our pilots to submit either iPad shots or photographs of radar screens which show the amount of clutter or the reflected echo from wind farms, not just off the sort of wind farms itself, but it has the effect it has on the ability to plot and track other vessels to avoid risk of collision. And the closer you get to the wind farms, from a 1 mile position right down to a sort of half mile position, we see that the amount of clutter or reflected echoes increase significantly. And one, there's an inclusion in my last submission which shows that we actually had one pilot who had a vessel on a collision course on his starboard side. The actions from the collision regs would require him to make an alteration of start to starboard, and although he could see that vessel visually, he was able to conduct that that manoeuvre safely. On the radar, he couldn't even see the vessel until the automatic vector picked up from the ARPA, the anti-collision software, which produced a vector. So had he been in restricted visibility or in traffic where he couldn't actually see that vessel to take a bearing of it to see if the bearing was steady, increasing, or opening to determine if the risk of collision exists, it would have been an incredibly unsafe situation, and that is purely because of the reflective echo of that particular type of vessel. So you might have a nice large container vessel or passenger ship with very modern radar equipment, but unfortunately that doesn't apply to all vessels that come down to the northeast spit. Also, different classes of vessels. You get vessels with self-discharging cranes, and so you get a lot of reflected echoes off the cranes. And then you get a lot of vessels with a lot of structure aft, such as container ships, which are loaded with 9-10 bays aft, which are loaded 6-8 containers high. You get a lot of reflected after that, and anything which might be overtaking you, you will lose in the clutter. So the closer you get to wind farms, then that to me is the obstruction or danger to navigation when you are close to such structures. And I just cannot express enough that we need this 1 mile exclusion zone, half a mile.
This is essentially the critical question. In your view, that the additional extent of structures exclusion zone is necessary to provide the additional safety margin that you see.
There's a lot of reasons why we need the 1 mile exclusion zone. I've supplied such a lot of data on sort of turning room required for a vessel, you know, and we're not talking about our 400 meter container ships or capstan size 330 ships, just the normal type of ships that we put onto Tilbury dock every day. Take something like, I did a study on the ship called the Balau, 210 meters long, self-discharging container ship into Tilbury dock, boarded it at the northeast spit. Three cables, that's a third of a mile before you can turn it around, and you end up four cables, four tenths of a mile to the north of the northeast spit rig convoy before you've got it on track, because you're at slow speed waiting for the pilot to come on board, and you've got traffic to contend with as well. So you get this sort of scenario, and that is just an everyday type of ship into Tilby dock. And so we need the room, the sea room of the 2 miles. There's been a lot of data given on that. But the point is that ship may be to the east of the middle of the 2 miles of sea room, and you've still got to turn them around. And when you're half a mile off a wind farm in a half a mile exclusion zone, apart from the fact that the master finds it extremely uncomfortable because
all you can see is massive big towers, and he knows that he can't turn his ship inside 8 cables. It's as simple as that.
Okay.
And you've got half a mile ahead of you. So it's now, an extremely dangerous situation, because that's the only way he's going to get the pilot board on.
We're clearly going to have an opportunity in the next two agenda items to go down to the detail of this. So we don't have to kind of take all of the detail here and now. It's just a case of flagging the policy and hearing your view about the particular attachment of that issue to this policy.
But I would just like to make the point is that the danger to the safety of navigation, in particular collision avoidance when you're half a mile off a radar, half a mile off a wind farm, because of the reliance on radar, it's such a lot of the times that the picture is just about unreadable. It's very, very dangerous.
Yeah. Okay, thank you very much. And now if I can then come to the combination of PLA and ESL.
Richard Jackson, Estuary Services. It does kind of add to what Mr. Symes already suggested, but I would say being a bit more kind of specific, I suppose, the nature of any obstruction or danger to navigation, I would say, is a result of the increase in traffic coming together. So it's the displacement of the traffic, the reduction in the sea room will be the nature of it, because you'll get the same traffic interacting in a smaller area. So the nature would be an increase in congestion. The extent is kind of, that's the hard one to put a number on, because you know, there's, who knows anything. I mean, I certainly don't think the NRA has done a, you know, there's not enough there to sort of pin a specific point on just what the extent of that congestion is going to cause and how that's going to be the problem. But the problem will be the congestion and the interaction of those existing vessels just working in a smaller area and doing what they already do in a smaller area. I think as well, it's right about the radar issue, is that I think the impact of the issues of the radar is still possibly not being given quite enough weight. I think Rule 7, the MSP document references Rule 7, which is about assumptions should not be made on the basis of scanty information, especially scanty radar information. So you're encouraged not to rely on a radar if you've got doubts over that radar, which is common sense. I mean, but of course, with the actual MSP document, they go a bit further to sort of suggest that if a service vessel exits a wind farm at a speed of 10 knots, then the reliance on the radar, the minimum distance needed to get a reliable CPA is 1 mile for those vessels monitoring that traffic leaving that wind farm. That's at 10 knots. So depending on what speed the vessel comes out, that will obviously be affected as well. So it's that combination knock-on effect of the reduction in sea room, I think, that would be the nature, I would say, of the problems being caused.
Okay. Now, are there any other matters from...
Actually, sorry. Richard Jackson, yes. Sorry, just one thing to add as well. When it refers to a sort of cumulative effect from other projects, of course, at the moment that's quite noticeable, because London Array, I think, is on a fairly sort of aggressive maintenance program. So we've seen a huge increase in the number of cats working at London Array, who use predominantly that western track to, you know, it's a north-south run for them to their wind farm. But we've gone from having somewhere in the region of 2 to 4 sort of service vessels to 12, and with the provision that we're hearing that will probably increase as well. So their traffic, actually, because it's fast, small traffic, and there's always this assumption that being fast and small, therefore you're this nimble character in amongst all the ships, but actually you're still a target, you're still a fast-moving target, and you're, from an AIS perspective, when you're looking at your bigger picture navigating through the area, that creates a significant stream. They've almost created a rush hour, because they tend to leave at the same time, they tend to come back at the same time. Because what London Array has started doing is they've started working nights. So from a cumulative point of view as well, we're seeing big increases in small, fast craft going through the area.
Thank you very much. Now, if I can come to the applicant for responses on that, relevance of the policy and responses to the particular points.
Scott Lynas for the applicant. Our position is that
There isn't any obstruction or danger to navigation which should have any effect on the grant of consent in this case. It's clear there's no obstruction in the sense that there'd be any prevention of vessels crossing on routes around the wind farm. And to the extent that one is looking at the effect of the scheme on routes, for the reasons we've given on our evidence, we don't consider that any effect is at all significant. And any assessment of the scheme under the previous paragraphs in EN3 would largely lead to the same conclusion under this paragraph, because the considerations are largely the same. And the same point applies to the question of danger to navigation. Our position is that as the results of the NRA show, we are in ALARP. We don't accept there's any danger to navigation as is being alleged. Therefore, for the reasons that we'll come on to and other aspects of the agenda, we don't accept that there is any danger to navigation resulting from this scheme. As for the individual points, sir, may pick that up in the later agenda items, if that's all right.
Yes, no, there's no need to labour. I mean, essentially our purpose here is to mark
the policy approach, exactly.
And essentially just to provide everybody with a what would be the final opportunity orally to draw matters of relevance to our attention.
I'm grateful. And as for cumulative effects, I'll come back to that generally below. But in short, the NRA and the ES both considered cumulative effects, including effects with other vessels. And that would include vessels relating to other wind farms. That was all fully assessed in the NRA and the ES and conclusions reached. And there are no cumulative effects which are, in our view, significant. Therefore, for all those reasons, we say that that aspect of EN3 is met in this case.
Okay. In which case, then, ladies and gentlemen, we can move on to I. This is a slightly more kind of processy one. We're referring here to 2.6.153 and the degree to which engagement between the applicant and maritime navigation stakeholders has ensured that solutions have been sought to allow the development and navigation uses of the sea to successfully coexist. And I mean, we have heard a number of IPs extensively on the point now around what, in their view, they consider additionally ought be done. My sense here would be that unless somebody feels that there is something that has been forgotten in the process that we have been through so far yesterday, that this is simply a case of us observing that policy position and continuing to provide, during the remainder of this examination, the opportunity for relevant interested parties to draw those matters to our attention. Does anybody disagree with that point and want to add anything further? Mr. Owen, can I just check around the room to see if anybody else wants to speak? No. So, Mr. Owen.
Sorry, I don't disagree with that point, but I would like to add something further.
Okay.
If I could, I mean, you're obviously aware of the background here, and we've put in writing and orally, of course, the history of our lack of engagement, but that's thankfully behind us. The point I wanted to make, and I'm going to bring in Mr. Crockett, is really partly in response to the response we heard at 6 o'clock or so last night from Mr. Linus about the risk assessment process. Which I'm sure we're going to come back to again this afternoon. But as this is a process-related point, perhaps we can just respond to it on that basis. And it's important, I think, you could perhaps be forgiven for, or those in the room could perhaps be forgiven for thinking that the risk assessment or an addendum that's before you is almost morphed into a a general document that everyone's signed up to. Of course, that's not the case. It is and always has been the applicant's risk assessment, and it's important to remember that. It's not for the process that this agenda item is referring to sort of come up with some sort of solution that is sort of jointly owned. It's up to the applicant to demonstrate the adequacy of their proposals and the absence of material risks, whether it's navigation or other interests. And Mr. Crockett wanted just to add some comments about the process that was gone through with the risk assessment, because he was there, as indeed was Mr. Hutchinson on his right-hand side. So, Mr. Crockett, would you mind just saying what you want to say?
Good morning. I'd just like to be very brief about it, in that we talked yesterday about perhaps the way that one would like to do it is that some sort of quantitative assessment, preferably a simulation, would inform the risk assessment. And I'll just briefly note here that the pilotage simulations notes it's critically important to note that the risk profile for pilot transfer operations has significantly changed, and the contingency latitude or room for error, and these are the words, has markedly reduced. And I think those words are quite important, because they would actually inform the risk assessment process. And I think it's fair to say that there is a mismatch between those very clear words, carefully chosen words, and the way that we're trying, we've accepted the general principle of the risk assessment, but what we're really trying to do is draw attention that two tools have been used, and quite rightly so, but there is quite a mismatch between that statement and the rather perfunctory approach of trying to come up with scores. Okay.
Thank you very much. Essentially, there, I think that those are points that have been kind of well made, and just essentially add to the broader considerations around the process by which the workshop component of the NRIA process was carried out, and obviously we'll give careful consideration to those. Now, Mr. Owen, is that everything on that point, or were you seeking?
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Okay. In which case, a response from Mr. Linus for the applicant.
Scott Linus for the applicant. Thank you, sir. As far as the policy test is concerned, our position is that there has been engagement between the applicant and maritime navigation stakeholders for reasons that we set out in the NRA Table 8, as well as further information on consultation, which is provided at deadline one. It's also important to bear in mind that there have been the pre-hazard workshop meetings and the hazard workshop itself, followed by post-hazard workshop teleconferences. So I don't think there's any dispute now around the table, certainly not from the Port of Tilbury, given the way that's been put, that at the moment that there is some sort of deficit in engagement for the purposes of that part of the policy. As for the particular point relating to the pilot simulation, it's important not to take that comment out of context, as we respectfully say, Mr. Crockett has, that's related to work, simulation work that related to the pre-PIR red line boundary. And the pilot simulation nonetheless found that pilotage was going to be feasible even in circumstances before the SEZ was introduced. And as I said yesterday, it appears to be common ground that any simulation, piloted simulation included, is but one component in a wider NRA, and that any judgments that any party wishes to make about a piloted simulation are then translated into the scoring that forms an essential part of the NRA process. And whilst we accept entirely that it's our NRA and we have to demonstrate the effect of the scheme, the policy anticipates engagement, which is what has happened. And as a result of that engagement, the other parties then must, in my submission, indicate where they think
the scoring system has gone wrong. And as I said yesterday, our understanding through the engagement that's required by policy was that a number of the important inputs into the hazard ID process had been agreed. So I say when you put that all together, it's important not to cherry pick single phrase from a pilot simulation that must be seen in the wider context when applying this policy. And for the reasons I've given, we say that engagement has allowed us to demonstrate that the proposal and other uses of the sea could successfully coexist, again, for reasons that have been explored in the evidence.
Thank you very much. Mr. Owen, briefly.
Sir, thank you. Can I just come back on that? You may well feel that this we can cover this later, but we do want to challenge and do challenge the and I don't know if this is a process point or a substance point. We do have some misgivings on the scoring, as I said yesterday, and is set out in our deadline 4C submissions. And actually, as I mentioned those, I should just point out that if you look at our deadline 4C submission, there's an important qualification to what we say about scoring that Mr. Linus didn't refer to yesterday. I make no point about that, but there is an important qualification there that should be noted. But we do have some concerns about scoring that go to the comprehensiveness of the risk assessment process that involved all the stakeholders around the table. And Mr. Crockett and Mr. Hutchinson are going to want to say some things about that. I don't know whether that's a process point to be taken now or under the following items of the agenda where we deal with scoring.
I have to say, I think at the moment what we're essentially trying to do is just to get to a point of agreement on the relevance and effect of certain policies, but let's put the detail in the detailed part of the agenda so that actually the stories can be told entire rather than chopping through the particular requirements of policy. Once we've agreed what policy is, we can then map the policy framework ourselves back onto the submissions.
Yeah, that's understood. So Mr. Linus is understandably painting a particular picture, and it's not one that we totally sign up to in terms of the overall comprehensiveness of the process that's been gone through, and we do want to make some points on that.
Yeah, we note that difference now, and certainly, we will be pondering considerably further on it as we move on in this examination. So a final policy point from the agenda, and that is whether the navigation risk assessment, including the addendum process here, has identified and assessed cumulative and in combination risks associated with the development and any other developments in the Thames estuary. And this is referencing to 2.6.157 of the MPS. Because of the interplay between these various items of policy, they all do somewhat overlap, but I did think I should give one final opportunity for oral submissions on this before we move on. Is anybody wishing to draw anything further to our attention on that point, or we're all happy that we've said what we need to say? Okay. Before we leave the policy point, there will be some questions from Mr. Bradley. But before I go to those, I did also just want to check whether there were any other policy points arising from the NPSs that anybody wished to draw our attention to as having a special role to play in our considerations of the subject matters of this hearing that we haven't already run to. We will, of course, read the MPS as a whole. We take every policy and evaluate the entire project against all of the basket of relevant policies. So the danger of things being individually missed, if applicable, is not a danger that we need to concern ourselves about. But this is the final opportunity. If anybody thinks that there is a really important and obvious policy point that needs to be made that we haven't covered off, in the agenda. Now is your time. Okay. Well, I think we can be clear that we know what the policy framework is in broad terms and your responses to it. Mr. Bradley, do you want to just check your question list?
Thank you, yes. I have just a few clarifying questions, essentially, for the applicant here. This is, firstly, in regard to the applicant's comments on the D4 submissions by the ports. The applicant refers to the IMO General Provisions on Ships Routing, so we'll use the acronym GPSR, henceforth. Would the applicant comment on to what extent the GPSR applies to navigation in the area of the Thanet wind farm?
General provisions on routing, to the extent that that's an IMO document, recognises, as far as we understand, that there will be IMO routing provisions which can be carried out through agreement and discussion with the IMO, and routing can be established on an international basis through the IMO. As we understand, it also recognises that domestic bodies may designate routes within territorial waters without necessarily the agreement of the IMO. But we return to the previous position that this would have to be charted or designated in some way. So we don't think that the general provisions on routing materially alter the submissions that we've given to you about the need for either charting or designation of some description in relation to routes within territorial waters.
Thank you. The follow-up question then is, if we look at the GPSR, Para 6.4 states, course alterations along a route should be as few as possible and should be avoided in the approaches to convergence areas and route junctions or where crossing traffic may be expected to be heavy. Now, this goes to the point as to whether we are talking here. A lot of the discussion yesterday was whether we were dealing with a sea lane. I think I want to get clarity here as whether we are talking about routes that are actually covered by the provisions of the GPSR. Mm. And the London Pilots Council deadline for C submission did argue that the development presents an obstacle to vessels approaching from the east, and therefore a requirement for course alterations, which were more substantial than in the present day. Would the applicant like to respond to that submission at this particular point?
I think
really essentially to test whether the GPSR applies in this context.
I think as an initial observation, Sir Scott Linus, for the applicant, our case is based on the proposition that there would not be significant alterations required to routing in a way that would engage the GPSR in this case. But I think perhaps we should take away that question, return to that specific provision of the GPSR, and then we can pick that up in any further written submissions that we make.
That seems a wise way forward.
Can we capture that? Can we capture that then as an action for deadline 5? And Mr. Syme, London Pilots Council will obviously have an opportunity to respond to deadline 5 documents.
I have a subsequent question, which is...
actually, Mr. Bradley, before you move on to the next question, I did just want to check back to see whether any other IPs had any observations to make on that point. No. Okay, thank you very much.
The GPSR, sorry, I beg your pardon, let's rewind. The D4 C submission of statement of evidence by the applicant submits the Nautical Institute World Ocean Council Marine Spatial Planning document, and let's call that the MSP document, if we may, for simplicity. Yeah. And would the... applicant comment on to what extent this document applies to the navigation in the area of the Thanet wind farm, And should it be given weight in this examination?
Scott Lyons for the applicant. Sir, yes, we say that it is relevant to navigation in this in the area of the wind farm, and it appears to be common ground, as we understand it, that it is a relevant consideration when looking at, in particular, sea room that's available in the inshore route and the route to the north of the site. As you'll be aware, I think all parties, as we understand it, including the applicant, have considered that document, and in particular its guidance on sea room for passage of vessels, and we've applied that to the Appendix 14 document that was submitted in relation to the SEZ. So that certainly that aspect of the MSP guidance has been taken into account, and we say some weight should be given to it for that reason.
Thank you. And let's hope that we're very close to concluding my questions here. In that document, that MSP 2013, page 3 refers to UNESCO guidance on marine spatial planning. And I wonder if the applicant could comment on the applicability of that guidance to the application in question.
Scotland is for the applicant, so I think we need to take that away, if we may. Thank you.
Again, can we just have an action noted on that? So that's the Nautical Institute, World Ocean Council. No, apologies, it's the UNESCO guidance referred to in the MSP document on page 3. Written submissions on the relevance of that by deadline 5, with again the opportunity for other IPs to comment thereafter.
Now, the purpose of asking these clarifying questions really is to know just which documents we need to respond to in our recommendations. But I think that concludes at the moment, Mr. Smith. Anything further from you?
Yeah, well, I will just finally check on that final point whether there's anybody other than the applicant who wishes to raise anything before we finally make that action concrete and make sure that it happens. No. In which case, unless anything else? Mr. Bradley, you're content with your questions as they currently are?
Indeed.
In which case, we can then move on to agenda item number 5. Now, I think here, if we look at agenda item number 5 and the matters that we are dealing with, together with agenda item number 6, there may be some virtue, and I will seek your views on this, in just cutting to the chase now and essentially identifying the particular persons whose expert evidence is to be put, allowing that to be put, allowing that to be tested across the table, and then we can wash up the remaining agenda items to the degree that any material is not apparent and questions are unresolved, and we can then test those in a slightly more normal manner afterwards. But that strikes me as the most concentrated, efficient and productive way of doing this, rather than essentially chopping on an issue-by-issue basis from individual expert to individual expert. Does that commend itself to those here? Anybody with a contrary view? We're essentially proposing that we go back to quite a traditional model of allowing an expert to be introduced. What I'm also going to indicate is because the papers have been put in at deadline 4C, whilst I would normally indicate with these matters that we would take everything as read and that we would move then straight into questioning on the material, I'm conscious that, you know, all of us haven't had particularly long residence time with this stuff, so I would provide each party introducing a witness with a very brief opportunity to summarise to the key points of their position as disclosed, because I think, in fairness, because we've had such a short amount of time with the material, it is sensible to have that done. Any final observations on how we do this.
Robbie Owen, so can I just be clear what you're suagesting, which is that in relation to agenda item 5,
yeah,
you're intending to, interested party by interested party, and then the applicant, invite them through their witnesses to,
yes,
deal with the issues they've got on agenda item 5, not in the A to B to C order,
no,
but generally...
Indeed not. No, I mean, my view is that it will actually be most productive to treat those statements that have been put before us as whole, to enable each of you to get to the end, in inverted commas, of your individual witness, and we can then go back across the agenda and just say, well, have we done with it? Have we dealt with this? Have we dealt with that?
So just check I understand it. Can I just, if you remember the 4 points that I raised yesterday, which are dealt with in our 4C submissions,
yes,
is the idea that we should, because all 4 points relate to this agenda item,
yes,
that we should deal with each of those 4 points with our witness?
Absolutely.
Yes.
Okay. And that then gives Mr. Linus a clear and unimpeded view of your position,
yeah,
and gives him an opportunity to raise any questions through us that he wishes to raise. And equivalently, when we get to Mr. Linus's experts, it will give you a similarly clear and unimpeded view of their position. I feel that actually would give us a simpler, clearer way through this.
I think that would be absolutely my view too. There's just one qualification, which is, would it be convenient if we could go around the table in the other direction, simply because I need to be excused for half an hour about now to attend to a personal issue and personal call I've got to make. And so therefore, I was wondering if we could start with, for a change, with the PLA and the ESL might want to start on this occasion.
Okay, but what I'm actually going to suggest, I think, given that we're canvassing the how, and that, you know, of necessity, somebody who is just about to then be put to bringing forward their material might need to have a little bit of time to think their way through it. Once we're agreed on the how, it is very, very early to call the morning break, but I'd be happy to call a 20-minute break. We can then enable the shift of mode with everybody having had adequate thought and preparation about it.
Thank you.
Yeah. Does that make sense? Is everybody happy with that approach?
Sir, Scott Linus for the applicant. Just one question of clarification, if I may. Obviously, on the agenda, item 12, mm-hmm, there is a separate item which specifically refers to cross-examination of witnesses. And I just wanted to clarify what you're anticipating as far as procedure is concerned now that we're dealing with 5 and 6 together. Entirely content to deal with it in the way that you've suggested. Perhaps it would suggest a brief break so that the relevant witnesses can be settled into what they're going to say. But I think, as far as any questions of other witnesses are concerned, were you anticipating that they would come forward through you as a panel as we go round the table with each witness, or are you anticipating that is all being left to a later stage under agenda item 12?
No, I would foreshadow that I would like to make essentially full progress on this now.
5 and 6, yes.
And you know, clearly because the national infrastructure process envisages all questioning processes remaining under the direction of an examining authority, we will intervene if at any point it appears that a line of questioning is not addressing the underlying agenda points and or is ceasing to assist us in terms of providing us with the information that we need to form a report. But other than that, no, our view is to go straight in.
Very well.
And we would, I say, you know, clearly need to set a break of some 20 or 25 minutes after this sort of procedural session in order to allow witnesses to be settled into their positions. And I'm perfectly content that if others are content that we might start with Estuary Services Limited and march this way round and then return to the applicant at the end.
Well, thank you very much, sir. Scott Linus, the applicant. In that context, then, if each of the parties' experts is being heard,
they understand it to mean then that, for example, if I have questions that I want to put to the PLA, I can do that before, for example, then asking one of my witnesses to respond to those points where it's more appropriate for you to hear expert evidence directly in response?
Yes.
Very well.
Absolutely correct. And then when you introduce your own witness, you may indeed then ask them to respond at that point.
Yes.
But of course then, you know, the other side will have the opportunity to question your witness once yes. you've examined them in chief.
Scotland, for that, I'm grateful it's not entirely formal. There's a slight hybrid element to it for that reason.
It's national infrastructure.
Yes.
It is hybrid.
Yes, thank you very much, sir.
Now, Mr. Owen has one final point, and then there are a couple of other points that I need to make before we then call a break. So Mr. Owen.
Thank you, sir. And just to be clear, we're dealing with items 5 and 6 together, are we?
We are. We're taking 5 and 6
yeah,
together.
I think that's very sensible. Thank you.
Because otherwise, we just have to do it again, which I don't see much point in doing. OK, before we go any further then, Mr. Bradley, there was, I believe, a quick point of clarification that you wanted to touch on.
Indeed. I think this might help. In particular in regard to the Section 5, just to understand a little bit about the basic assumptions that were taken in the workshops that led up to the deadline for and subsequent submissions. Now, I have not been able to understand from the submissions whether it was agreed that, or indeed the intention to agree, that the safe sea room distance was calculated to the rolling 500 meter construction safety zone or not. That's point one. And point two, which I think is probably worth answering at the same time, is whether there was an agreement as to whether a clearance distance was required from the navigation marks, in particular Elbow Buoy and the Northeast Spit Raycon. Certainly the figures that have been presented seem to indicate the dimensions being measured right up to the buoy position and indeed right up to either the red line boundary or to the edge of the SEZ.
Sir, Scotland, we will pick those up. Sir, we have those points in mind and we can address those when we come back.
Thank you.
Okay, so one final running order matter before we break. So as everybody's absolutely clear, who is speaking, when they're speaking. So can I have then an indication from Port of London Authority and Estuary Services Limited as to who is to speak, because you will be coming first. So Estuary Services Limited first. Yes?
Yep.
Okay. London Pilots Council,
yes.
You will be next. UK Chamber of Shipping, we don't have a pre-disclosed statement from yourself, so we take it that you will not. Now, can we come to Trinity House?
On this occasion, Captain Toby Harris will speak on our behalf.
Okay. Captain Harris, MCA, no. And then finally, Mr. Owen.
It's Mr. Crockett and then Mr. Hutchinson in reserve if we need evidence on the process and the workshops. But okay. It's primarily Mr. Crockett.
Primarily Mr. Crockett. So that's the order in which we will proceed. We will then come to the applicant.
Sir, Scotland, for the applicant. That's very helpful, thank you very much. Just put a marker down. I may wish to hear both ESL and PLA first, if I may, before deciding how I allocate any questions or how I allocate any points to my own witness, because obviously we've got a single statement from them both, and it may be easier for me to hear both witnesses before we decide how to proceed.
Yeah. Now, PLA.
We're happy with that approach, given that our submission was a joint one. Okay. Alex Dillestone from Wimble Sherwood.
Excellent. Right. Well, that's clear too. So it seems as though we have framed the ground rules. It is now 11 o'clock. I had suggested that we probably needed at least a 25-minute break for folk to settle into the next part of the process. Why not be clear and generous and say 11:30? We will resume at 11:30, which I'm sure will give everybody time to mull over what will happen next. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much.